From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the release of new polling in Iowa. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg had surged into the lead, now polling at 24% of Iowa Democrats. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are the next choices, 18% apiece. Then in New Hampshire, new polling averages put out a new lead for Buttigieg there as well. The man known as Mayor Pete averages 20% of New Hampshire Democrats. Sanders is second at 17%, Elizabeth Warren dropping to third at 14%. For Senator Warren in particular, the last month has seen her lose a significant portion of her support in early primary states. Now, nationally, former Vice President Joe Biden still holds the lead. He sits at 28% nationally, Sanders 18%, Warren 17%. Buttigieg checking in fourth around 10%. But if you look at the last 20 years of elections in particular, there are plenty of stories involving candidates who checked in right around 8, 9, 10% on Thanksgiving week, and they ended up winning the nomination. John Kerry, of course, is just one example. We haven't talked much about Pete Buttigieg on this program, and so this hour, we get a closer look at who he is. We'll also discuss why some more progressive Democrats say they don't trust him. Our guests this hour include Alex Udelson, who is chief of staff for the city of Rochester. He is a volunteer organizer for the Buttigieg campaign in Western New York, and among the local sphere of politicos, Alex was the first to say this guy could do this many months ago. So you're looking forward to saying, I told you so.
Yeah, it would be probably my first I told you so, because 2016, we were all pretty confident, and we know how that went. So.
Well, yeah. And look, prognostication is a dangerous business, but Alex, thanks for being here. Nice to have you. Alfred Vitale is here as well. He's the co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics, an adjunct professor at MCC, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
Why is it, Alex, that you gravitated to Pete Buttigieg and his campaign right from the start?
Sure. So I actually first met Mayor Pete like 5 years ago. I was working in the Obama White House in the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. So we dealt with all the, you know, mayors and governors. And he was a frequent flyer there. You could always tell he had, you know, this sort of ambition about him. But I'll never forget, he, at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, there were around 200 mayors there. He stood up and asked President Obama a question about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it was sort of equal parts challenging the president, but also kind of helping him with his messaging, but also almost answering his own question for him. And we were all, I remember all the staff just looked at each other being like, who is that guy? And like, wow, what, you know, where did this come from? And so I've sort of been following him since then. You know, he ran for DNC chair, you know, blew people out of the water. If it were a secret ballot, he would have won that, you know, hands down. And I think, you know, when you look at who Democrats have elected over the past 75 years, right, we've always sort of been the party of youth and hope and optimism. And in this sort of environment that we have, I think Pete is really focused on changing our politics, right? We've been under the Reagan era for 40 years now, and nobody's been able to change that, including President Obama. And so he's really looking at the day after Trump is defeated. We're not going to be healed at all, and we need to fix the systems first. So everybody can argue about the nuances of policy on stage and, you know, go back and forth on healthcare policy and, you know, all of the other issues. But, you know, you get to the Senate and Mitch McConnell says, no, thank you. And then where do you go from there? And so how do you rally the country around a presidency that's about something more than just policy, that's about redefining an era, not just winning an election? I think that's sort of how I've, you know, seen his candidacy from the start. It just feels different to me. And I'm a little biased because I got to know him pretty well. But, you know, I've just been impressed with him from the moment I've met him.
Now, before I turn to Alfred for his view on this, I'm thinking about a number of different themes that we will talk about this hour. You referenced healthcare. We're going to get there. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about coalition building. And you know, right now, if Pete Buttigieg wants to win a national election, he's going to need a core base of African-Americans and Latino support that so far hasn't shown up in the polling. We're going to talk about that coming up here. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about a theme that I think for the first time in recent weeks, I've gotten my head a little bit better around the idea of what centrism is. And I want to get your take on this. Mm-hmm. So, in this sort of the sphere of Democratic candidates, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Biden are viewed generally as centrists. And we had a conversation earlier this year in which a political commentator named Douglas Jay, he was taking aim at the David Brooksian sort of goal of centrism in all things. Like, mm-hmm. why can't we just cooperate and be bipartisan?
Right. Right.
And Doug said on this program, he said, look, if I want to nuke nobody and you want to nuke 100,000 people, let's just nuke 50,000 people. Well, that's the centrist position. That's the lampooning of centrism. The way I have come to see substantive centrism is this. I think centrists view the current system as maybe inadequate, but not in need of an entire teardown, that we can fix problems within, whether it's the ACA, whether it's capitalism, economic systems, social safety nets, that we can do better, but we do not need a teardown. Whereas those who are not centrists say that we have seen enough and we know that we are going to have aching inequality without systemic change. That's kind of how I view centrist. Now, what do you make of that?
I think that's interesting because I don't view myself as a centrist. I view myself as a progressive, and I view Mayor Pete as a progressive. And so I think
you can be a progressive centrist, though. Can you? Can't you now?
I guess so. I mean, so my personal philosophy on it, and it's part of why I support Mayor Pete, and I think he would share some sort of philosophy of this, is that, you know, things are only, you know, good and right and moral to the extent that they're practical. So I actually think, you know, I would personally say, and I think Mayor Pete would say, that the system does need to be torn down, but we can't do it. And these are the steps that need to happen before we completely reform the system. So, you know, when you talk about healthcare, when you talk about another system like that we have, I think all of us probably agree that it's completely broken, right? We were just talking to someone who had to wait, you know, 3 months for an operation at the VA. Nobody thinks that's good. But when we talk about, you know, the path to get there, again, it's how do you galvanize the country around a process and an idea and a policy position that can get you to the end goal. And
so it's incrementalism?
It's to some degree incrementalism. But, you know, if you take the Green New Deal, for example, you know, PETA said that is the only practical thing to do because time is running out. You know, that's the practical thing to do is the Green New Deal. In other cases, the practical thing to do might be Medicare for All Who Want It or whatever he's, you know, calling it. And that would eventually get us to single payer, right? So I think he's really unique because he kind of takes the policies one by one and says, what's the problem? What's the solution? And how do we get there? And is it practical? And do we need to change systems, especially democratic systems, right? So I don't believe you can change the healthcare system before you change the democratic systems that we have between gerrymandering, the Electoral College, the Supreme Court, you know, Mitch McConnell, cloture, you know, all of that stuff. I don't think you can actually change these policy systems until you change our democracy. And I think that's the most appealing part of his candidacy.
So he's a pragmatist. He's an issue-by-issue pragmatist.
I think he's a progressive pragmatist, if I had to define him, yeah.
Alfred, you are not supporting the Buttigieg campaign. Let's start with why, and then we'll talk about what you are supporting.
Well, I'm not that's a strong way of putting it. To be honest, I haven't put a lot of thought in Buttigieg's campaign. Frankly, up until yesterday or the day before, I really wouldn't have considered him even. I mean, I looked at the polls and thought, oh, that's interesting. But I think part of the reason I don't believe he's actually going to wind up in the spot at the end of the primaries to be the Democratic candidate is because I think he's an investment in the future of the Democratic Party. What I really think is his emergence is a response to a left insurgency, in particular people like AOC, who are galvanizing people. And similarly, Pete Buttigieg has taken some of that language. I mean, embracing the Green New Deal is a good example. I see he's very good, from what I've read and from what I've seen in his own words, he's very good at couching what are ostensibly sometimes technocratic, sometimes, you know, yes, pragmatist, but also centrist lines, and really couching them in a progressive veil, which the problem is progressives see through that very easily. And I think he's going to have a very hard time convincing progressives that he's one of them. He's certainly going to do very well with that group of people I was mentioning before the show who are, you know, they are left of that liberal place. They're sort of progressive leaning and they want something to anchor themselves to, and they don't have a home. They see Biden they see Sanders as too far away. They see Warren possibly as kind of in there, but they don't want to vote for Biden. And I think the Democratic Party also knows this, too. I think deep down, Buttigieg is a sort of insurance policy for Biden's inevitable collapse.
But explain something to me here. When you say progressive see through what Buttigieg, what are they seeing through?
Well, he hasn't. Let's just start with the flip-flopping, for example. He speaks like someone who is being groomed by, and let's face it, Zuckerberg, and there are Silicon Valley people who are advising him on his decisions on staff, for example. I think he hasn't said a lot of substantive things. He was what was it, last year, I think he supported Medicare for All, and in a way that was bizarrely like, I unequivocally, hereby state, I support Medicare for All. Well, being a pragmatist, I think the Democratic Party in general likes to think that flip-flopping is a sort of sign of growth and development. But there's no evidence to say what Pete Buttigieg will actually do, because his time in politics has been very short.
Okay, I think we should differentiate flip-flopping, which I view as more opportunistic based on the political winds, versus taking new information and factoring that into your decision-making. It sounds like you think he's being an opportunist.
He's a smart guy. He's a smart guy. I mean, he has a lot of... His military background gives him a lot of experience and know-how. Yet, he supported the war in Afghanistan until as recently as 2014, which is kind of odd given his current position, which seems to be a lot less... inclined towards that. Maybe flip-flopping is a strong word, but yeah. You know, there's the consistency. 37 years ago, Bernie Sanders, when Buttigieg was born, was saying the same things he's saying today. Now, granted, that might seem, you know, maybe stagnant to some people, but Biden changes his position all the time, and I do not think people see this as an authentic growth more than they see it as an opportunistic way of using the language that is currently popular and important to sort of pull in a base. Not a bad strategy from
sure.
Electoral.
But yeah. It's interesting though, because I think part of the sort of reaction you've seen to Pete over the past few weeks, it's sort of he's gone from, you know, people being really interested in him, you know, both progressives, moderates, people who don't align neatly on a spectrum, to sort of the far left, you know, whenever, for lack of a better term, the far left, whenever sort of someone rises and threatens their candidate, they you know, gin up a bunch of stuff, especially on Twitter. And so the war in Afghanistan in 2014, I mean, President Obama was president then. So I wouldn't say Pete's position back then on the war in Afghanistan is that out of line, who's someone that I consider a progressive president, even though I'm sure you would disagree on that. But so I actually
well,
don't think...
I mean, there's lots to show, as you certainly know, that the shift is not... The far left is not as far left as it was, especially the far left in the political arena in terms of electoral politics. Mm-hmm. Certainly Bernie Sanders is not far left.
But when, Alfred, do you view Barack Obama as a progressive?
No. Absolutely not.
Okay, go ahead, Alex.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, so that's sort of the difference, right? So I guess, you know, I don't think that I'm not expecting the DSA to endorse Pete for president.
The DSA is a small organization in the world.
But so I think that branch of the party won't like President Obama. They won't like, you know, Mayor Pete. Mm-hmm. I doubt they would even like Elizabeth Warren, right? I think they would be pretty much behind Bernie. But I don't think Pete's, whether you call it a flip-flop or policy evolution, or in my opinion on healthcare, for example, his goal is still Medicare for All. It's just how do you get there? But I don't think that those are all of a sudden to the right of where the party is and that he's pandering to some sort of base. I mean, these are policy positions that are mostly actually, I think, to the left of where President Obama was. And
so
it's been that sort of like micro reaction to his rise in the polls that has brought up and I think ginned up a lot of this stuff. That's really like when you take a step back, there's 20 candidates on stage. And if you were to somehow align them neatly on a spectrum, which I don't think you can actually do, I don't think Pete would be in the right five. I think he would be closer to the left five. And so that's why I don't buy the sort of recent, you know, digging up of past videos and statements and tweets and, you know, like making it seem like he's some corporatist. And the Zuckerberg thing is nonsense, by the way. But
if we could, let's listen to what Pete Buttigieg himself said on healthcare.
Yeah.
So and to kind of frame this up here, to Alex's point, there is kind of this movement for, you know, who is in the center, who's on the political right among Democrats, who's further to the left, who wants to accomplish certain goals on healthcare. And Buttigieg has taken some fire from supporters of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, among others, regarding his criticism of Medicare for All or single-payer system. And let's listen to what Pete Buttigieg said recently regarding healthcare.
Medicare for All who want it means we take a version of Medicare and we make it available for every American. I believe that this will be a better option than any of the private plans out there. I also believe Americans ought to be able to decide for themselves.
So the ultimate end goal is a government-run healthcare system.
I think that's that it's going to lead toward everybody or almost everybody opting into that public plan, but you're not required to. See, the important thing to me is not whether or not the government's the main insurer. The important thing to me is that everybody get care.
Does your plan require a tax increase for middle-class Americans?
No. We can fund what I am proposing without raising taxes on any but perhaps the top 2%. Now, I do believe that our tax code needs to be fairer. There are corporations and very wealthy Americans who should be paying their fair share and aren't. And we're going to adjust that, not just in order to fund our health care plan, but in order to fund the needs of this country. It's not punitive. It's not unreasonable. It's just what we need in order to make sure that we can move forward as a country.
That's Buttigieg on the CBS Morning News. Now, let me start with Alfred, because I've got some, I think there's a lot of different layers here. Let me start with this. What do you not like about what you just heard there?
Oh, I think a lot of what he said was what has been said for the Medicare for All people in general. I think that the incremental part is a little bit worrisome to me, because the Green New Deal, as we know, is the climate emergency clearly is an acute crisis right now, but the healthcare emergency is an acute crisis. We can fund anything, and we've always been able to fund things. The political will, the willingness to say to the donor class, no, we're going to be doing X, Y, or Z instead of the other. I think he's right that the end goal should be that. I think this notion of choice is a very privileged notion in general, because most people don't have choices. They make decisions, and not everybody really cares whether or not they have choice of their healthcare provider if they actually can get to one and afford one. So I think his end goal might be right, but I'm not sure that we have any more time to waste in slow motion. And because, like you said perfectly, Mitch McConnell and the Senate, you know, there are a lot of obstacles to things that are not just the president's responsibility.
Well, to that point, if the makeup of the Senate doesn't largely change, you can put any policy, 1% progressive or 100% progressive, it's going nowhere.
Right. Well, so
you're saying let's go for
it. Let's go for it. I mean, the Democrats from the get-go of Trump's presidency, for example, should have been united in refusing and rejecting every single proposal they put forth. They should have put their war face on and said, no, no, no. But instead, they constantly waffled with this belief that they could somehow negotiate or somehow work a deal, and they've shown over and over that that's not the case. So I think we're at a point where there isn't a lot of time to pretend that the political process that exists is going to work. This is a post-positivist view that if we just try harder to do this, it's not going to...
Fair, but you seem to be capitulating already, whereas Buttigieg might say, no, we are going to pass something. We are going to move this down
that's
the road.
That's what Obama did. You can pass something, but is it when? What is the line of acceptability to what's okay? Like, well, when Obama passed the Affordable Care Act, well, look, maybe 100 million Americans who used to not have health care, now we have 40 million Americans without access to health care. Or
is that better?
Is it better? But it doesn't have to be 40 million.
Yes.
It could be zero. My point is,
well,
that
I don't think it could. And I think if it politically, logistically could, we would all be there. I think
disagree with completely.
Oh, I mean, speaking for me,
nice idea.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I think Pete's approach, right, again, because we have this Senate, which is atrocious, right? And we've got gerrymandering.
Conservatives think it's great.
Right. Conservatives think that's the last bastion of, well, the Supreme Court, which they now have locked in for like 40 years unless we do something. But, you know, so you've got the political feasibility of something, right? And people said when, you know, we first tried the ACA that there was no chance it would work and it's going to be dead on arrival. And there were the town hall meetings and the public outcry, but also the community organizing that went behind getting that law passed, pressuring lawmakers. And some of them, like Tom Perriello in Virginia, lost his job. I mean, he voted for it and got defeated the next day. And we had one less member in the U.S. House of Representatives and lost the House, right? So there's political repercussions to these things. And if you take a 4 or 8 year view of a president, we can't just go out there, have something really big fail, and then lose seats and not be able to do anything else. So I believe you have to really galvanize the country around the idea of coverage for everybody. And that's something that we did. And it wasn't perfect, but at least there were, whatever it is, 60 million more people.
I don't know that we've galvanized the country on this. I think part of the problem is that the mixed messages that keep getting sent. I mean, no person is getting the same information on any given day about either an affordable, Pete's suggestion, Bernie's suggestion. I think the media especially has made it confusing. I think people take things like, well, you're going to tax the middle class, where for people who don't understand that they're already paying. We're already, mm-hmm. this is already cost. You are not getting free health care.
Let's talk about the tax question, because I have a problem with this on a couple of levels here. So let's be hypothetical. Let's say your taxes are $5 and your health care premiums are $5. Then now let's say your taxes are about to be $7, but your premiums are $1. So your overall cost is $8. It used to be $10. Your overall costs are down. The media is fixated on right. getting candidates to admit you're raising taxes as if the overall cost doesn't matter. Now here's the issue I have. First of all, the correspondent from CBS News is sort of playing that while your tax is going to go up, as right. opposed to asking if costs are going up.
Yeah, yeah.
Second of all, Pete Buttigieg, in an earlier debate, said that he basically came to Elizabeth Warren's defense and said what matters is not the actual bottom line tax rate. It's whether the overall package of what you pay is less.
Right.
And then in a later debate, he's trying to pin her down on what you're not answering the question if your taxes are going up. And he starts to sound like the criticism from the right. I thought that was a little cynical of him. At the same time, Warren has been a little less transparent than Sanders has been about what's happening with the tax component.
Right. But yeah. with your example, say your taxes go up to 12. And your premiums go down to zero. I think that's the question he's getting at, is are they going to go up and how much? Because you can't answer that question of what is going to be your total package of costs at the end of the day without having an actual plan of how it's going to be paid for. So she's assuring people that at the end of the day they will be paying less. But I guess until you see the numbers, and again, right, so that's the idea. You campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. At the end of the day, she has to take something to Mitch McConnell and beg and plead him to do it. And it's not going to work if we haven't galvanized the country around it, made it clear that there's going to be political pressure on those who oppose it, and that there's a real plan to pay for it. Because at the end of the day, people still vote on their pocketbook. They really do. It's a fundamental
thing. You're giving the voters a lot more rational thinking behind these decisions than has been evident. I mean, when people said, I'm against Obamacare, but I'm supporting the ACA or whatever, sure. you know, that constant. This is what we're up against in the world. And because we're not unified in a commitment, we can say this about the Republicans, as terrible as they are in virtually everything, they commit to a position and are willing to throw themselves under the bus to get it. They're willing to do whatever it takes for a position, terrible as it is. And they win because they have the commitment and clarity. It's terrible stuff, but it's clear. Medicare for all. What did Pete calling it? Medicare for all, but for
all who
want it.
That's essentially the Sherrod Brown plan. The Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should accept that this is what we want. I mean, you talked about Obama. I mean, he wrote a book called The Audacity of Hope, and now we're like, whoa, let's not hope for a thing that other countries have been able to do all around the world. Mm-hmm. Because they have the will to do so.
Yeah.
We have the will to pay for things. I mean, we have the money and the resources to pay for things. We fund. I mean, if we start looking at our military budget, for example,
we can
bail out an industry instantly to the tune of trillions. We could do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Buttigieg's position on student loan debt's a good example. Mm-hmm. Sanders was trying to get elimination. Warren wanted mostly eliminated. And I think Pete was saying, well, we want to cap what people should be able to.
His concern is that there are too many people like who are already well off who would have their student loans forgiven, and they're already wealthy.
Yeah.
And that there ought to be sort of a recalibration of how to help people.
But when you use that argument that it benefits the wealthy also, what you're doing is ruining it. Because if you make something that is, in fact, for poor people only, then everybody complains it's an entitlement and blah, blah, blah. There isn't a win unless we just say, no, it just has to be cut, period, end of story.
For everybody.
It should.
You're starting to sound like Andrew Yang with the UBI. For everybody. We don't means test it.
Yeah. I don't see a problem with that. Student loan debt, they bailed out the industries that get bailed out. There's not a long sort of moral, you know, conflict about should we do. It becomes this is important because it stimulates the economy. Economists rally around this idea. We all know that the student loan debt crisis is affecting the economy.
I guess I would just say, I think the philosophical counter to that, though, is that say in that program, say it's a $500 million program, and 20 million of that money goes to, very wealthy families who could very easily pay off their student debt. I would just rather see that 20 million go to something else.
I'd like to talk about that mythical thing of the wealthy families that can't afford to pay their student loan debt. Wealthy families don't incur the same debt. That's part of the thing. If you're wealthy, the University of Rochester, for example, the most expensive college around, most of their students don't have student loan debt.
I don't think it's most.
No.
I think there is
60% or more that are not receiving financial aid.
Right. So, well, let's just say there's some amount of money, right, that is going. And again, I agree that SUNY schools and community colleges aren't overflowing with wealthy students that have, you know, debt and all of that. But say there is some amount of money, which there would be. Philosophically, wouldn't you want that money to go towards rebuilding our bridges or doing something else that's a public good? I think that's the general disagreement.
If it helped my students at MCC, for instance, pay off their student loan debt, I'd be willing to be okay with that because a $20,000 debt, which is a small amount in the average number of student loans for undergraduate tuition, a $20,000 debt can be crippling for people who are starting at a disadvantage to begin with. I am fine with us eliminating it all in general. But we have to ask one question, which we're not getting to, and it's the same with the healthcare, is we're talking about this, all of the onus is on the taxpayer, the population, the people, not the industries, not health insurers, not pharmaceutical industries, not the banking industry, who do have the ability to make these changes, and they don't.
Well, we're going to get to that theme in a moment here, and at least we're getting some substantive difference, but I've got to take a phone call from a woman named Karen. Alfred, I think you know her. She's with the DSA. Hello, Karen. Go ahead.
Hi. As somebody who's advocated for single payers for the last 30 years, I can tell you that the plan that Bernie has for Medicare for All is very well thought out. I go back to advocating for the Russo bill, which was a federal single-payer bill in the 1990s that had some bipartisan support. I want to explain to people why Medicare for people who want it is problematic. One of the things that's happening right now in our patchwork healthcare system is that everybody's health insurance is being subsidized by the U.S. government, including people who have employer-sponsored plans. We need community rating, everybody in, so that the risk and the most expensive people with the highest numbers of needs are sort of the most expensive on the system are mixed in with young people and healthy people who aren't costing the system very much for now. All of us will be expensive to the system at some point. So when you have a Medicare for the people who want it, what it means is that you're taking the people who can't afford a private plan or who lose their jobs because their employer can't afford to put them on their health insurance. You're putting the healthiest, cheapest people in the for-profit plans, and you're having the government subsidize the cost of people who can't afford those plans. So everybody has to be in or it's not going to work. The other thing about the assessment that voters need to make about which plan is going to benefit them personally is not just what is the cost that I'm paying now, what is the cost that I would pay in taxes, it's also what benefits am I going to get? So anything that falls short of a Medicare for All plan means that we're buying into this privatized system of decisions that profit makers are making about what can be covered on a plan. It means we have to fight the insurance company to get coverage for a condition that we have. It means that our primary care physician has to call up and spend unreimbursed time every day fighting with the insurance company to get the medication that we believe we need. The thing that the media isn't saying about Medicare for All is that it's coverage for everything. It's expanded Medicare for people who are elderly. It's no more of this like Part B, Part D, Part C for Medicare. It covers everything, including dental. And it's paid for because we've got people paying into the system who are healthy. We've got people paying into the system very, very little if you don't have a lot of money. And we've got employers paying into the system. And we've taken the profit out. So the other consideration is, do we have candidates who are willing to tell people who are making profit off of illness and denying coverage and raising prices, this is not acceptable? We will not protect your profits. And that's profits. That's not operating costs. That's profits. Right. I am looking for a candidate who will say to greedy people, you don't benefit from our illnesses anymore.
All right, Karen, that's the argument against the Buttigieg plan for Medicare for All who want it. Thank you, Karen. Alex, what do you say?
Yeah, so I actually, surprisingly, I don't disagree with that from a policy perspective. But, you know, once again, we're back to, you know, how do you get a bill passed right now in the United States? And roads go through, you know, with the absence of just overwhelming public pressure and public opinion that forces Republican senators to act, you know, how does this get done? And, I get that we and whoever we are, whether it's supporters of Pete or the center left or left of center left, we always sound kind of down in the dumps, like, oh, that's a great idea. You can't do it. But it's just the reality of it. And so, you know, we go back to letting sort of the letting the perfect become the enemy of the good. I think that is the final state of things. And it's the best healthcare system, and other countries have done it. But I would guess, and I'm not a, you know, comparative political expert, but I would guess that, you know, Sweden didn't have a Mitch McConnell that could stop things with one
that is a
signature.
That is the, you're right. You are 100% right. So the Democratic Party has done not enough to stop the Mitch McConnells. You talk about public pressure, though, right? And we capitulate, we negotiate, we chat. We don't put a lot of public pressure, enough public pressure. Mitch McConnell happens to be an isolate. I mean, he's an kind of a very powerful person in a very unique position in that regard. But you're right. We do need to put the public pressure, but we're not going to get public pressure if we're still waffling about what we're fighting for. I think we haven't been really clear with the American voters in sense that this is actually a partisan battle, right? The Dems are really good at saying, we don't want to sound partisan. We don't want to sound partisan. Well, if you say, you know what, we are being partisan. Our impeachment is a partisan activity. Let's just mm-hmm. be honest and clear. If the Democrats were more transparent, I think they would get more people pushing back and fighting and sort of galvanized to see Mitch McConnell as the actual enemy he is, mm-hmm. and not the sort of guy on the, you know, he's on the news article, but he's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, look, and I think everybody understands that Mitch McConnell is an enemy that we can influence, right? I don't think it's been for lack of effort. You know, the Justice Garland nomination was the most absurd thing I've ever witnessed in politics. But, you know, when you look at New York State, for example, right, the New York Health Act is being debated, and it will probably be passed this legislative session. There's an all-Democratic Assembly, Senate, and governor. That's great, and it's going to work, right? Because we've, through the work of the advocates and, you know, the elected officials, we've gotten to a point where that's possible. There are Democratic members of Congress who stuck their neck out just for the ACA and voted for it, like Tom Perriello in Virginia, and got their neck cut off for doing that. And that took some political courage, because even with all of the battles and the debates, we still couldn't get public opinion to a point where people weren't talking about death panels. And we had the messaging, yeah. and we had all well, of the well, retorts, but it just wasn't,
it's not
we,
just,
it didn't feel like we were ready for it.
It's not
then.
Just Fox News. I mean, you're right. We didn't have the messaging. This is what my point is. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the politicians have messages that they have. They have clear positions, et cetera. They're filtered through a number of different media outlets mm-hmm. in different ways. And I think we haven't controlled that narrative. An example of this is the recent report, the Democrats, it was in, I think, Associated Press. The Democrats are concerned because they don't yet have a real clear sort of front runner, that they're a little worried about their choices and that. Well, that's a load of crap. If they decided that, for example, let's look at the candidates. I mean, even Biden, who I absolutely think is the worst of all of them with no qualification. But if they said, listen, that's it, we want to really rally around Biden, they could have done something different. But they're not, because they know he's going to put his foot down his throat further and further. But Bernie Sanders, for example, often polls similarly or better against Trump and Biden. And they never bring that up in anything. It's always Biden will beat Trump by 10 points. And then you read, oh, Bernie would beat him by 7 points. Well, that's not a blowout, apparently, but Biden's, it's spectacular. That kind of messaging sends up, it's a problem. It's not clear and not consistent.
I don't buy that. The messaging around polling a year out from an election, though, when not all the candidates are known in their positions, and Trump hasn't even really started his campaign yet, and that's going to create a whole new dynamic.
Well,
and so, you know,
I'm late for our only break, and when we come back from break here, we're going to hit some other subjects in regards to this race, particularly with the news that if voting happened today in Iowa, it looks like South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg would win Iowa, and he could very well win New Hampshire. Joe Biden still holds a pretty comfortable national polling lead, But of course, you got to win states in the Democratic primary if you want to be the nominee. And the question is, what does the recent Buttigieg surge mean? Is it too early? Why are certain voters gravitating in this direction? And substantively, how would he govern? Alex Udelson is a volunteer organizer for the Buttigieg campaign in Western New York, and he has known Mayor Buttigieg for more than 5 years now. Alfred Vitale is a co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics, an adjunct professor at MCC, a member of the DSA. And when we come back here, we're talking about who supports candidates like Pete Buttigieg. That's next. Coming up in our second hour, how do schools teach Thanksgiving? Are they teaching more myth, more fairy tale, and less reality? Or is it changing? Are schools doing a better job of being more realistic with students about what happened to early settlers and with early settlers and Native Americans when it came to dispossession, genocide, and more? The Thanksgiving story next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So when we look at the rise and success in early polling so far for Pete Buttigieg and his desire to be the Democratic nominee, the question becomes who is and who is not supporting a candidate. Where are the coalitions come from? Recently on CNN, Dr. Cornel West had some things to say about who is supporting a candidate like Pete Buttigieg, who is supporting candidates like Bernie Sanders, and the difference that West, as an author and scholar, sees between the electorate that supports these kinds of candidates. Let's listen.
You and I know we live in the political age of Bernie Sanders. Everybody's got to talk about medical care for all. Everybody's got to talk about $15 for a living wage. Everybody's got to talk about what are you going to do with student debt. Bernie wants to eliminate it. We've come now to the context in which Bernie Sanders is setting the tone and the terms of the debate. It's just a matter now of acknowledging the establishment in the Democratic Party is unraveling. When you look at the Bernie Sanders campaign, what do you see? Major contributors. Walmart workers, major contributors, teachers, Biden, Harris, Buttigieg, major contributors, elites, those at the top. It's a very different orientation. We are witnessing the awakening of poor and working people of all colors coming together in solidarity to save this democracy.
Fair or unfair, Alex Udelson?
You know, if you were to take, you know, everybody's talking about the poll in South Carolina that showed Mayor Pete at, you know, 0% among black people, right?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about race in just a
but,
moment.
But you know, the last bit about, you know, coming together, you know, all races, creeds, religions for Bernie. I mean, still, Joe Biden is polling first. He's polling first by far with African-American people. And so
yeah, that's true.
I think we often, you know, so from the perspective of a white person, I guess, in this, we often sort of use race and other things when it's convenient to our argument, right? So we sort of use, hey, look at this. You know, I've support this candidate. And so one potential argument against them is African-American people aren't supporting him. But that's sort of an issue that to me is between the candidate and that community, right? It's really not for me to decide when there's enough support or not enough support. You know, that's going to have to be a process. You can't win an election without building a coalition of, you know, not just race, but socioeconomic status. I mean, working people are still the backbone of the Democratic Party.
So let's return to race just a second, and let's hit what Wes said. He says the people supporting Buttigieg, Harris, Biden are the elites of the left. The people supporting Sanders, probably Warren, are more of the working class.
Yeah, I don't buy that. First of all, because if you added up all of their polling numbers, it would equal the vast majority of the Democratic Party, and I don't think the vast majority of the Democratic Party are elites, and I don't know what that word is defined exactly as, but I still believe that, you know, first of all, working class people, there are probably a lot of them that are supporting Bernie, probably a lot that are supporting Warren. There's probably the most that are supporting Joe Biden. I mean, unions have already come out and endorsed Joe Biden. So I don't agree with that.
It's interesting you brought up the use of race in that, because Biden's a good example. The whole reason Biden keeps getting the sort of the attention is they keep every time he's mentioned, it's prefaced with, he's still polling very high among African-Americans. When it comes to Buttigieg, it's, well, he's not quite there yet. But that's okay. The Democrats have no consistent message with this either, and I think that's part of the problem. Also, they also operate as though every voting bloc is a monolith. I mean, essentially, like black voters. Well, the Biden numbers, well, if we break them down by age, that changes. If you break them down by region, that changes. Mm-hmm. And that might also be true for Buttigieg. It might be different. So those kind of demographics are not really useful. And I think you'd agree. They're, at this point, they're rhetorical, you know, things, not substantive.
On the subject of race, I mean, I take Alex's point that sometimes, whether it's polling, issues can be sort of manipulated to benefit or hurt campaigns. At the same time, I think you've acknowledged that right now, Buttigieg is surging in early states. These are mostly white states. Yep. He cannot win this nomination if he doesn't pick up significantly more support among African-American voters, among voters of color. And you agree with that. Yep. And one of the ideas that's being floated now is his record as South Bend mayor going to hurt him, whether it's in dealing with police community matters, or other housing, other issues. Here's what Pete Buttigieg recently said in regards to the subject of race, which has come up often for him recently.
While I do not have the experience of ever having been discriminated against because of the color of my skin, I do have the experience of sometimes feeling like a stranger in my own country, turning on the news and seeing my own rights come up for debate, and seeing my rights expanded by a coalition of people like me and people not at all like me, working side by side, shoulder to shoulder, making it possible for me to be standing here wearing this wedding ring in a way that couldn't have happened two elections ago, lets me know just how deep my obligation is to help those whose rights are on the line every day, even if they are nothing like me in their experience.
Just, I mean, he's referencing the fact that as a gay man, he has experienced discrimination in this country. And actually, at his campaign launch, no matter what political party you support, or I would hope that you would find there to be a lot of beauty in the moment where he and Chastain went out together and shared a kiss and held hands and walked across the stage to thousands of people going nuts for him. Mm-hmm. That is what America ought to look like, no matter what. And that was a beautiful moment. Is that enough, though, for him to say, look, I'm a white guy, but I've been in the shoes of being discriminated against, and I'm going to learn, and I'm going to reach out. Does that carry weight?
No, I mean, it has to some degree. I mean, this is a historic presidency. We're following up two presidents ago, a very historic presidency. This one is historic for other reasons that we're going through now. But, you know, I don't think that's enough alone, and I don't think he would think that's enough alone. And my experience, I mean, you know, in my short political career, I've only actually ever worked for African-American people. I had three bosses at the White House. They were all African-American, and I work for the mayor. And first of all, I'll say, you know, working for this mayor, these issues that he deals with in South Bend are in every city in America. There is not a single city that has figured them out. They're really hard, and they're going to require a lot of work, you know, in the future. But I will say, you know, my experience working with that community is people in that community support you because they see that you've been there. They see that you've been an advocate. It's frankly less about the specific policy positions and more about, have I seen you? Do I know you? And so when you look into, you know, that South Carolina poll, for example, you actually see that there aren't negative favorabilities for Pete. It's that he's relatively unknown still in South Carolina, and that will change. And there's been other polls where he's polling, you know, in South Carolina among black people above Kamala or Cory Booker, right? And so Joe Biden still has that overwhelming sort of reputation just because he's been around. But as this campaign goes on, I mean, even though Iowa's in a few months, we still have a long ways to go before this is settled. And he's going to have to prove himself to those communities. And I don't think anybody thinks that you can win in 2020 without that coalition. And I know that he knows that and that they're going to do their best to, you know, prove themselves. And that's all you can ask for as a candidate who listens like that.
On the subject of who backs whom, Dan from Webster says, based on what Cornell West was saying, he's pretty sure Pete Buttigieg has the most people from Wall Street backing him. Did you hear it that way, Alfred?
Yes, I heard it that way. You know, Dr. West is an amazing rhetorician and speaker, and he's very persuasive. I don't disagree with him. I think he's right. I think one of the things that's been most troubling to me about the post-2016 election is how we still haven't acknowledged, for example, that Bernie Sanders' base is in fact a diverse coalition of people, both racially and in terms of socioeconomics. We still have that little narrative of he's not polling quite well. Well, Biden's an unfair. If you pull Biden out of the race, that changes the calculus completely.
Yeah, but he's in the race. I mean,
he's in, well, of course he's in the race, and he's going to do what he always does, which is lose a president. He's going to just continue to do that. I also want to point out one thing about, I don't think the impeachment proceedings could be ignored in terms of what's going to happen in terms of primary season, because if we actually do have an impeachment going to the Senate, that does change some of the campaigning for many of the candidates that are at the table right now. Not Pete Buttigieg, but it might also be a factor in some of that. And I think it's really interesting that I said this before the break. It's kind of early, and it isn't really in terms of the political calendar. I mean, we know the primaries are coming up, but so much can happen. So I'm not quite sure we can bet on anything, really.
Well, let me read some feedback from listeners as well here. Richard says, who is a Buttigieg voter? I am, either he or Klobuchar. Ex-protester, now a pragmatist. We need change, but change comes incrementally, except on climate change, our biggest problem. And Steve says, hi, Evan, I'm a liberal who has considered joining the DSA. I am also all in for Mayor Pete, even though some dismiss him as too centrist. For me, Pete is an inspirational leader. Is he perfect? No, but no one is. With Pete, we progressives would get most of what we want. I implore my fellow liberals to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and to support enthusiastically whoever the nominee is. Democrats tend to win when we pick someone inspirational, like JFK, Bill Clinton, Obama. We tend to lose when we nominate uninspiring career politicians. For many of us, Pete inspires passion and hope, much like Obama, however imperfect he may be. Alfred, what do you say to Steve?
I don't think that's far off the mark. I mean, I it is true. And again, I'll go back to the fact that we do have charismatic, passionate presidential candidate nominees. There's no absence of them. I mean, it's not just Bernie. I think there is some. I think Pete's a good example. There are people who are persuasive and passionate. I think we have a stumbling block in that we do have, I go back to Biden, his existence in this race is really ruining the chance to swing this further leftward, I think. At least, because if you take him out, I mean, I think Pete Buttigieg starts to look a lot more progressive. I think he's just sort of
But Alfred, you said earlier, you do not view Barack Obama as a progressive.
No.
Was Bill Clinton a progressive?
No, gosh, no.
Okay. So the point is, the emailer is saying, we would love someone like that to win. What you're saying is, we don't want to go back down that road.
We don't want to go down that road. I want to go back to the point, which I think was really astute, which was bringing up what Mayor Pete said about wearing the ring. He's right. That was, in our lifetimes, Evan, you and I are older than Alex, or that, I mean, 30 years ago, the thought of that is just, it's insane to think it was possible, but it happened. Well, why is this not the view we take with, why is it suddenly not pragmatic to think about Medicare for all, as because it's a pipe dream, but it's pragmatic to assume, like, things change. Nobody could have predicted some of these things 30 years ago, 25 years ago. I don't think we should just say we have to keep being incremental.
But do you view it, Alex, having heard your sort of argument for incrementalism where it makes sense, the view of, you know, the lesson from same-sex marriage is equal marriage happened in some states, here, there, across the country, and then all of a sudden you've got Anthony Kennedy and the Supreme Court taking it up, probably because it happened incrementally.
Yeah. But think about it this way, too. So say we're back in 2004, and this is, I think, sort of the fundamental sort of, because I actually think we probably agree on more than we would realize here. A lot of it is around process. But keep in mind, Karl Rove put marriage equality on the ballot in states knowing it would be unpopular and that people would come out. And from our perspective, you know, if you fast forward to 2020, if we were having the same conversation about a different topic, I think sometimes the far left would say, well, we should do it anyways, regardless of the political ramifications, because it's the right thing to do, because that policy is the right thing. And it absolutely is. But look at what, I mean, it's just the reality of what happened in 2004. And it took us another 12 years to get there. So I think there's a lot there. You know, a lot of it is we agree on the sort of final, you know, place, but we don't necessarily agree on how to get there.
I think people are just tired of waiting, though. I mean,
you
know that's true.
It's crises.
In our last minute and a half here, I want to get your take on whether this bolsters Buttigieg or is a problem. Joan says, I like Pete and Amy and Biden. I am a Democrat, but but several of my Republican friends have told me Republicans for Biden. They would also, they would perhaps vote for Biden, not Trump. And she's wondering, would they also vote for Buttigieg, not Trump? Is that a problem? What does that say to you?
I don't think so. I don't think the Republicans who would vote for Biden, I'm not sure they would go as far as voting for Buttigieg.
So I actually think, so we have a Rock for Pete group that, you know, if we have had 40 people at our last few meetings, I would say actually 5 to 10 of them have been Republicans and independents because they don't like what's going on. They're very concerned. And I think Pete has a way of taking progressive policies and explaining them and distilling them in ways. Actually, I mean, you said it kind of the reverse. You think he has moderate ideas that he couches in progressive values.
Yeah,
I think he has progressive values that he couches in moderate terms. And I actually think that he is the only candidate that is running for both the primary and general election right now. I think everybody else is just running a primary election campaign, and that Pete knows that once this primary is over, we have a really tough battle. But even after we win the really tough battle after the general election, we're not going to be healed. We are going to be in a state of chaos, and that in order to have any chance of being a successful president, you need to really unite the country in that general election.
Yeah, but I don't know that this is where we're going to hit the rubber is going to hit the road. If our goal is to sort of pull in middle of the road Trumpists who are sort of not quite sure, I don't think that's going to be a good strategy.
I don't think
that
should be the goal.
It negates the progressive cred, as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
Alfred Vitale there from DSA. You're a member of DSA.
I am.
Also an adjunct professor at MCC and co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Alex Udelson is a volunteer organizer for the Buttigieg campaign in Western New York. He's been pulling a lot of weight for Mayor Pete since the early days, though I have a feeling we're going to see more infrastructure as time goes on, but I hope you come back. Thanks for being
here. Absolutely.
Short break. More connections coming up.